Hello, and welcome to You've Got Time, an Orange is the New Black podcast. As per usual, I'm your host, Erin Quayle, and this week I got a chance to talk to a friend of mine, Jillian Tans. She'll talk a little bit about her counseling experience in the podcast itself, but she and I sort of became counselors and went into the therapy field at around the same time, so it was really great to catch up with her and talk about the episode and kind of our differing opinions on things that, that have been happening on Orange is the New Black. So this is the third episode. We're diving into the third episode of the show, entitled Don't Say Anything, which focuses on Brooke Soso's flashbacks as well as some other things going on in the prison, and I think we had a really great conversation, so I can't wait for you to hear it. Jillian and I kind of talked a little bit about some things that, you can find online. So as usual, the links that we mention within the podcast can be found on the piece that will be up on Hidden Remote about the podcast, in addition to our website, youvegottimepodcast.com. So we're also starting a kind of a new thing at the end of each episode. The guest and I will be talking about pop culture moments and references in each episode, because that's something that's definitely, I would say, a hallmark of Orange is the New Black, that they kind of weave those cool pop culture references in to, you know, keep us topical and keep us kind of laughing and thinking as well. So, please, we definitely want to hear from you too about what your favorite moments, pop culture moments are in the episodes as well. So please send them our way. As always, you can contact us at on Twitter at You've Got Time Pod. On Facebook at facebook.com/YouveGotTimePodcast, and online email through YouveGotTimePodcast@gmail.com. So we'll get right into it. I hope you guys enjoy. Hi, I'm here with Jillian Tans, and we are talking about the third episode of Orange is the New Black, and I'm so happy to be here with her today, because we're both, you know, in the therapy field, and she has a lot of expertise that I don't necessarily have. So if you want to talk a little bit about yourself and where you come from,
sure,
and then we'll dive in.
Well, I am a licensed clinical social worker in Connecticut. Primarily, I'm working with the eating disorder population right now, but previously I had worked in a nonprofit community mental health agency, working with folks with all sorts of different mental illnesses all across the spectrum, helping them to get jobs, get education, graduate from college, all sorts of stuff like that. So I'm really excited to talk about this episode.
Yeah, and the place that that she worked prior to that is called Laurel House, and you should all check it out if you have an opportunity to do so.
Absolutely. It's a great place.
Mm-hmm. It's fantastic, and there should definitely be more of them. What's it? It was originally a clubhouse, right?
But yeah, it was originally a clubhouse, which is a really unique kind of a program. The first one is Fountain House in New York City, which some people might be aware of. Mm-hmm. But there's like over 200 of them all over the world, mm-hmm. and they're basically kind of like self-help communities for people with mental illness.
Mm-hmm. And they kind of help each other, and there's mm-hmm. therapists there on site to kind of help them through, and they get responsibilities and mm-hmm. all sorts of great stuff that help them integrate into the community mm-hmm. and, you know, live their lives.
Yeah, because the reality is that although society often doesn't mean to, we sort of end up pushing people with serious mental illnesses to the fringe of society, because mm. it's just, it can be difficult sometimes to integrate them and to people have a hard time dealing with differences, right? Mm-hmm. So, especially with all the things that compound a mental illness, like poverty and racial inequality and like access to healthcare and all the social things that go along with it, places like Laurel House are really necessary.
Yeah, and it's definitely, there's a lot of, like you said, people get pushed to the fringes because of, misunderstanding, but also because of fear a lot of times, because people fear what's different. And those mm-hmm. communities kind of help them, you know, integrate into society in a way that's like more organic than maybe other ways that would be.
And it's creating a supportive community, which people often lack, or they have to somehow cobble together on their own, which is what the people at Fountain House originally did when they started it. So it's pretty cool. It's, you know, kind of like, you know, built up from the people who would otherwise be called quote unquote consumers of mental health services.
Right. And they have agency because they have responsibility for stuff within the program as well. So that's great. And they get to talk to other people that, you know, that know what they're going through. And that's a big part of it too, is, you know, recognizing that and being able to feel like you're not alone. So, so we're actually going to dive into the first episode and talk a little bit about Lolly, because Lolly, this week, actually, there's been like a round of interviews with Lori Petty, who plays Lolly on the show, and she's so great. And actually, the other day, I told my sister, I said, and you might not realize this either, but she played Kit in A League of Their Own.
Oh my God, yes. And I can't tell you how every single episode, I'm like, I wonder if this week we'll get to see a visit from her sister, played by Gina Davis.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. That would be amazing. Oh,
but yeah, every time I see her, I can't get Kit out of my head.
I know. Well, I didn't know until, because she was so good in the first couple episodes she was in, and I don't even know how
her voice is so distinctive, though.
It is. That's true. It is. But she does have like a cadence on the show that's a little different.
That's
so
true.
I think she kind of, and she's also, you know, a little older and doesn't have the hair or the peach skirt or whatever.
The Racine Peaches.
Yeah, and so she's, so it's just funny to know that she was, that's like, that was her breakout role, and that's where I remember her from, and she's so different on this show.
Yeah, I've clearly seen that movie way too many times.
Yeah, I've seen it. When I was a kid, I watched that movie all the time. So it kind of was, like, surprising to me that my sister, nor I, recognized her from that when she was on the show. It's a testament to how well she, you know, goes into her character on the show. But, so her story kind of open and closes this episode. At the beginning, she's worried about the garden. At the end, there's the drone, and it's kind of, like, freaky for her. But
it would be freaky for me, by the way. I mean, let alone if I was paranoid and having, like, hallucinations.
Right. Forget. I mean, forget about that.
Yeah.
It's still definitely a scary thing to see the drone. I think, what are the other... Cindy says something like, she thinks, oh, she was like, we're not an Iraqi wedding. And I don't actually understand that.
I think that's probably a reference to, like, drone strikes hitting the wrong target.
Ooh, yes, okay.
Yeah.
Because she's usually so light with her references, and that's definitely, yeah, that's, okay. So, yeah, that's probably what's going on. But, so they all have their own theories as to what's going on, but Lolly seems very certain that the drone is there for her. And so that's definitely something, like, a, you know, definitely part of paranoid schizophrenia and part of, you know, their... She feels like that's something that's part of this delusion that she's been having, that the CIA is after her and all of that. And so it's hard for her to kind of let that go. And it's hard for her to kind of, you know, I mean, it's hard for Alex and, well, Frida doesn't really care. She's kind of just like, I buried it in the garden. It's fine. I moved it. She's like, whatever. But Lolly and Alex are obviously having problems with it in very different ways. So, but Lolly is, you know, due to her disorder, it's harder for her to kind of move on from that. And so I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I think it's hard for me, having seen episodes afterwards, to like not use my information that I know from that, but just, I mean, what we've seen of Lolly previously, like, this is a really stressful event. You know, killing a guy who's trying to kill your friend and chopping him up and burying him in a garden. I mean, that would put anybody in the hospital, right? But for somebody who's vulnerable to, you know, delusions and hallucinations like Lolly, she must be just completely rattled and stressed by that. And, of course, it's going to aggravate what she's already dealing with. You know, I was really struck in this episode and later on also by how she's not getting any treatment. She's getting zero treatment. And we always hear the statistic of, like, oh, yeah, the prison system is, like, the largest mental health provider in our country. Which is sort of true and sort of not, because, like, in her case, she's not getting any services, you know?
Well, maybe it's supposed to be the largest. It should be the largest mental health provider.
And, of course, you know, like, I haven't worked in the prison system. I don't really know how close Orange is the New Black is to reality, but I can't imagine people are getting like stellar services. Mm-hmm. And you got to imagine like a large majority of people are dealing with mental health issues, mm-hmm. just from being incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that alone would stress me out.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, I had a client pretty recently who came out of prison and he had PTSD just from being in prison. And it was, you know, it was awful. He came out and he actually got a medical marijuana prescription, but that's a whole that's a whole other story. We were like, maybe not with the medical marijuana right now. But he, you know, he got a diagnosis of PTSD because it's dehumanizing, and there's people in there that are, you know, manipulative. It's just, mm-hmm. it's a very stressful situation that's not like how it is when we're out here.
Yeah.
And, you know, prison can create mental health. Forget about helping people with mental health problems. Prison can create all sorts of mental health or aggravate them as well.
There's so many problems in this system. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help thinking throughout, like, watching this entire series, really, about, like, the showrunners and the writers must be looking at what's going on with Rikers, mm-hmm. and the decision that was just made to, like, not have anyone under 21 go into solitary. Mm-hmm. And I think about, like, the Khalif Browder incident last year. I don't know if...
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, I mean, so this guy, you know, he was incarcerated at Rikers. He spent two of his 3 years in solitary.
Oh.
And he turned out to be innocent. He was not tried. This was 3 years, like, no due process.
I'll find a link to that article and I'll put it up with the
episode. It's all over the New York Times. Mm-hmm. But he came out and he committed suicide afterwards.
Yeah.
I mean, and like, you know, I can't help thinking about what's going on with Sophia, and mm-hmm. you know, I think that they must really be paying attention to that.
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, and like you said, knowing information about later episodes, they're weaving a lot of that real world stuff throughout the season. I mm-hmm. feel like, you know, last year they had the battle with the Emmys about whether or not they were a comedy, and this year, and then the Emmys were like, nope, you're a drama. And so this year they took it and they ran with it, and they took as many things as they could. And
I didn't even realize that was like on the fringes of my awareness, that's mm-hmm. interesting. Yeah. They really do seem to be taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Like the content.
Right. You know? And like you said, I mean, there are issues with solitary all over the country. And mm-hmm. I guess states are kind of, from just the reading that I've been doing, states are kind of starting to make changes to that. But at the federal level, they're kind of trying to encourage changes at the federal level. And obviously, in Orange is the New Black, it's a federal prison. Mm-hmm. It's not a state prison. So
right.
I actually, in the first episode, I linked to an article. Texas has been doing things where they, you know, are decreasing solitary confinement. In Texas, of mm-hmm. all places, right? Mm-hmm. They're decreasing solitary confinement. And I think they're in pilot programs in mm-hmm. different places and doing education and mental health. And they're finding that, you know, they have to put in money on the front end, but in the back end, there's less recidivism and there's, you know, less people going into jail because they're trying to put people in programs before they stick them in, because, you know, programs are also kind of a relatively new idea. Like the IOP program I used to work at, we always used to tell people, like, you know, they wouldn't necessarily put you in this program first. If you, like, had dirty urine on probation, they'd just throw you back in. They mm-hmm. wouldn't put you in this program.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an opportunity for you, and prison should be a last resort. But
that's
not always in every state. That's not always how it's treated.
And we're really suffering from the ramifications and the fallout of the war on drugs here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think finally there's been some national attention paid to that at the level of the president, level of the presidential candidates with, you know, the huge, overwhelming crisis that we have with opioid abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I just think, and there's so many parallels in terms of, like, what we're talking about with the prison system to, like, our medical system in general,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, even though we have, quote-unquote, Obamacare now and people have to have insurance, like, I still don't think that we're encouraging people to get preventative care as much as they should and could.
Mm-hmm.
And so we end up paying more on the back end,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we could, the upfront costs, if we invested more in healthcare, in education, in corrections, in, you know, all those things, mm-hmm. you know, we probably would have, we would pay a lot less and we'd have a lot less people's lives destroyed, right?
Right, yeah. And like, you know, in the previous episode, we were talking about, and the MCC people were talking about, you know, they get all this money. Of course, as a private corporation, they want the money. Mm-hmm. They don't want all of these, you know, education programs, mental health programs. They don't want all of that because it decreases their monetary flow because people are dollars to them. So
it's tragic because, you know, our country is footing the bill. You know, mm-hmm. taxpayers are footing the bill for private companies to make tons of money off of mm-hmm. human beings.
Right.
Which is just like our for-profit health insurance company structure. So, yeah, you can tell that I have opinions on this topic.
That's okay. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you're here. I remember thinking, a couple of years ago, I heard about, like, for-profit prisons that were, there was, like, a judge who was getting kickbacks. I think it might have been in Florida. Don't quote me on that. But, mm-hmm. like, there was a judge who was getting kickbacks to refer juveniles into the prison system for, like, really minor stuff. Mm-hmm. And these, like, 16, 17-year-old kids were just cash cows for mm-hmm. this company.
Yeah. Probably minorities more often than not, too, so.
Yeah, especially mm-hmm. those who don't have savvy parents mm-hmm. or, you know, come from the system anyway and mm-hmm. just don't have the protection.
Yeah, and don't have money to hire a lawyer or don't, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, or don't know the system. Mm-hmm. And that's, yeah, that's a whole other topic, too, that we'll get into later in the series as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just, you know, and in the prison systems themselves too, because they're not willing to kind of put the time in to hire quality mental health people. Mm-hmm. They get these people that, you know, I don't know, in this episode we don't really see the veterans come on as guards, but they're hiring veterans as guards, which is a horrible idea because they're all PTSD addled, like they have all sorts of issues as well, presumably.
Well, I haven't seen the last couple of episodes, but so I don't know if that happens, but I don't know. I didn't initially think like, oh, terrible idea. I thought like, oh, there's a possibility that that could be a part of the story. Like mm-hmm. some guard is not properly trained and like has some kind of trigger and whatever.
Well, we've also seen, I mean, you know, setting aside the veterans for a second, we've also seen that the other guards haven't really been properly trained either. The very first episode, they don't know how to put on the riot gear. They're taking forever. They don't know what to do.
No, they're basically temps. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, where did they get them from? Like, the side of the road?
Well,
like,
one of the guys, Charlie, who, you know, raped Pensatucky, he was from his donut shop. Like, how did he get a job? You know, I mean, not that he's, you know, maybe he has a college degree and we don't know. But you know, how did he get a job as a guard, you know, from, mm-hmm. you know, clerk at a donut store to guarding these women and protecting them, or presumably protecting them, but not really.
Yeah, I mean, I think I mourn the loss of Porn Stash as a character because he was fun to hate. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to find the heroes among the guards mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. show.
It is.
And even like Joe Caputo, who you kind of root for as like the quote unquote good guy, mm-hmm. it's like he seems to be getting corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And he's being allured a little bit by the money and the power and the mm-hmm. you know, and it's sad to see, but it's very human also.
It is, yeah.
Those are human inclinations. The farther away you get from direct service or from the people that you're trying to help,
mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it can be hard to keep your eye on the ball there, and you have to be a really yeah. principled person. And I don't know how principled he was in the beginning.
I mean, right. Yeah. And that's so true, too. I always, you know, I've been, like, it's fun to think about being a supervisor or, you know, kind of going higher up in the chain if you're working for an agency. Mm-hmm. But it's, at the same time, you lose that direct client care. Actually, the last supervisor I worked for, she was awesome. She, even though she supervised two different clinics, she had a very small caseload because mm-hmm. she was a gambling specialist, mm-hmm. but she would see like 5 clients a week mm-hmm. and she kind of just kept her hand in that mm-hmm. way.
And I think that's important.
It's really important because
you also have to start to see the staff as your clients. You know, mm-hmm. you have to see them as the people that you are helping so that they can help the clients.
Mm-hmm. Instead of just managing from high above mm-hmm. and like, you know, making sure, you know, you meet government guidelines and making sure all the paperwork is done. Because, you know, for listeners that aren't necessarily in the industry, there's a lot of paperwork.
Oh, yes.
There is just so much
especially
paperwork.
Especially if you're working, like, a nonprofit, like where mm-hmm. I used to work. I mean, we had probably, like, 4 or 5 different funding streams just from mm-hmm. my itty-bitty little program that served, like, 40 people a year.
Mm-hmm. And they all need information and different paperwork filled out and different treatment plans. And it's difficult because it does take away a little bit from client care, but it's understandable because they need some sort of metric to measure the program. Mm-hmm. But it's like a double-edged sword that way. But with prison, I'm sure there's a lot of paperwork going on there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember which episode, it's not a spoiler, but like somebody said to Healy, like, oh, aren't you the one who does the paperwork?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was Pensatucky who was like, he was like, you know, I help people. And she's like, you do paperwork.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's true.
Yeah.
It is. I mean,
you're the one who fills out the paperwork for the shots.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't even want to get started on Healy because every time I see his little nameplate with the MSW, I just cringe. Mm-hmm. I'm like,
yes.
No, how did this man become a social worker?
I know.
He's so deluded.
Mm-hmm. And he's just so, and I'm sure you have encountered people, you know, and I'm not like, you know, super self-actualized or anything, but but I'm, you know, you have to be able to separate yourself from the clients. You have to be able to, and that's a whole other thing. We can go into transference and counter-transference and all
that. I have
a lot
of counter-transference about Healy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think I may have said in the first episode that if he was a counselor and I was working at a large agency, I would be like, don't go to Healy. Like, you don't want Healy. Like, I would try to protect my clients from Healy because I don't know if at Laurel House you had like different caseloads or different counselors, but I've worked at agencies where there have been like 20 counselors on staff, and sometimes clients would get bounced around from my caseload to another caseload for scheduling reasons, or you know, I worked the night shift, they worked the day shift, the client needs, you know, all sorts of different reasons. And Healy would definitely be a counselor that I would be very wary of, you know, working with even in a group setting, just because I just feel like he's so toxic and he has so many issues that he has to work out himself that he has no business.
Yeah.
No business.
He's with a very vulnerable female population, and his issues are with women.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, he's got some serious, I won't get into that, but he's got some serious counter-transference of his own.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first,
and he's not self-aware.
Mm-hmm. The last season, we did see a little bit about his mom being crazy. So, well, not crazy. Well, we don't exactly know. From last season to this season, we don't exactly know what's up with his mom. We just know that she's something
I think we knew
wrong
that she left
her.
Him.
Right. Something happened. There was like, he was on the church steps and then, yeah, something. There were a couple like small little flashbacks last season. Actually, next episode is the big Healy flashback. Mm-hmm. So we'll get into that a little more next week. But Healy is definitely, you know, he's a very complex character, but he's definitely not one that I would want counseling anyone. And he was also instrumental in getting Birdie fired last year.
Yeah.
And she was actually she wasn't the best, but she was actually a much more competent counselor.
She was more professional for sure. I mean, she took her job seriously and it wasn't about her own gratification.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Whereas for him, I mean, he's just leaking that neediness, you know, it's just oozing out of him, and Red notices it, and, you know, it's, I think probably Pensatucky can see it, she spends a lot of time with him, and she actually kind of, like, cares about him in a weird way, they sort of, like, take care of each other a little bit, so he's not a black and white character, I don't want to say that, but he definitely pushes my buttons.
Yeah, no, mine too, for sure. And he has helped a couple people, but, you know, with Brooke, he was like, you need medication, like, something's wrong with you, and, you know, and then, but he did help Pentatucky, he has helped Red in, like, a weird way, and I think, I don't remember if it was this episode, but it was one episode, and she was like, he asked her if he was a good counselor, is that this? I don't remember if this is, and she said, like, just the fact that you're acknowledging that we have a special relationship should give you the answer to that question.
Boundaries.
Yeah, there's no boundaries there.
And, so many red flags.
Yeah, he's just crazy. But to kind of pop back to Caputo for a second, I definitely wanted to talk about Tacy's receptionist job because it was a big thing in this episode. It was a big thing for her because she was like, is this because I won job fair? And that calls all the way back to season two, where she was so motivated and she was, you know, Tacy's
was
like,
that before or after she got out of prison? I can't remember.
She got out in season one, I think, and then she was back. Uh-huh. And then season two, she went to Jobber right before V comes. So, like, it's, like, this big positive thing for her, and then V comes and, like, shatters everything because V was awful. But,
She got hers.
Yes, that's true. She did. Yeah, and so Caputo puts her in that situation, but, you kind of see, you know, you see Caputo being good, like nice to her and like treating her like a person and, you know, giving her this responsibility. But then you see him talk to Piscatella and he's like, what do you say?
He's like, she's one of the ones who is smart enough, but also I don't find her that attractive.
Right. Like he's something like semi intelligent who I'm only semi attracted to. And yeah. I'm like, okay, well, okay, that's like, I don't know, I guess it's like...
And Piscatella looks at him like, are you nuts?
Yeah.
You know, he just kind of cocks his head. Mm-hmm. But I actually really like Piscatella as an addition to the show, mm-hmm. because you get to see like a different type of guard. Like, all you've seen right. is like these Homer Simpson type guards so far. These like just bumping along, like, you know, just doing their best, kind of screwing everything up guards. Mm-hmm. And Piscatella really takes his job seriously.
Right. That's true. Yeah. He's really the first person we've seen take his job. I mean, it's not necessarily with the best mindset, but he is taking his job really seriously. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, him with Tasty was kind of a sad part of that, because Tasty's taking her job so seriously. She's trying to be mm-hmm. professional. And he's like, we're not equals in any way, even mm-hmm. though they are, like, they could be, like, you know,
who, yeah, in another... Yeah, I mean, I kind of see his point, though, because, like, for him, he has to maintain order. And he right. showed up when the riot was going, well, not the riot, but, like, they were all out of the prison. Mm-hmm. Like, he had to basically come into this Charlie Foxtrot and, mm-hmm. like, just smooth everything over and reestablish a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's probably really aware of, like, we can't be equals. If you think I'm your equal, then you're going to run roughshod over this prison.
That's true.
That's a slippery slope to who knows what. Mm-hmm. So I think that, like, of course, everybody's equal, you know, like, in my world.
Right.
But in prison world, I could see why he would have to maintain that really hard boundary.
That is true. And I've never worked in a prison system either. And I, you know, hopefully shortly I will have someone on who does work in the prison yeah. system. My husband's cousin actually works, I'm hoping to have her on. She works in a men's prison as a therapist, which cool. is like crazy to me, but like, but she does it and she, mm-hmm. you know, she definitely is a professional. So
oh, I can't wait to hear that interview.
Yeah. Well, hopefully she'll come on. Lauren, we want you on. But so I've never really worked in that system, but even with counseling, sometimes it's hard to, you want to be an equal, but mm-hmm. you also want to have that, you want to have that boundary, obviously. Mm-hmm. You want to be equals, but at the same time, some people will take advantage of that.
I think there's a difference between treating someone as an equal, as a human being, and, like, remembering that there's a power differential, mm-hmm. you know?
That's true.
Because no matter what, in any therapeutic relationship, like, this person is coming to you for help. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not really on a parallel, you're not on the same ground, mm-hmm. really, because you have, like, an obligation to look out for their best interests. Like, you can't be their buddy, mm-hmm. you know?
That's true. Yeah, and therein lies all the ethical boundaries right. and things like that. But I think Piscatella takes it a little too far. You know, I understand what you're saying, but mm-hmm. I love Tasty, and I felt bad.
No, I love her too, but I don't think, she didn't look too ruffled by it.
No, that's honestly. True. Well, she's also, you know.
She's just like, watch me go.
Right.
We're going to yes. You're going to watch me go.
And she's also used to that type of treatment coming yeah. where she's coming from yeah. and being a Black woman and, you know, I don't know exactly, but not necessarily. You know, in a great part of New York or wherever she lived, you know, she's probably used to being, and she also was in the drug trade too, so she's probably used to being, you know, yeah. mishandled by the authority figures and mm-hmm. things like that. So, and she's, you know, she hopefully is going to get that watch out of it. So, so yeah, that's a good trade off.
Tasty's getting her perks.
Yes, she is. So, but elsewhere, you know, the prison's falling apart. Some of the inmates, Piper's, again, I don't know how you feel. I would like to hear how you feel about Piper. Piper is the worst.
She's just the worst. I'm sorry. I love the show, but why is she the main character? She's like the least interesting person, and she's so narcissistic. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jenji Cohen, the creator of the show, she, I don't know if you've ever read any interviews with her, but she basically said Piper was her Trojan horse into this world of all these minority characters and other, quote unquote, other characters.
And the real Piper did write the book that, like.
And the real Piper did write the book, but really, you know, so this blonde, cute, white lady, mm-hmm. you know, it's her way in. And it's nothing to do with Taylor Schilling, who plays her. It's mm-hmm. just the fact that Piper is just such a.
The character's so
she's not likable. Yeah, she's not likable at all.
But I think you're right that, you know, it is kind of an entree for, like, those of us who might otherwise not watch like a prison drama, mm-hmm. You know, like I'm a white lady, you know,
right?
Like,
yeah, me too.
I can identify with somebody who's never been to prison mm-hmm. and who did something stupid and 10 years later pays mm-hmm. the price for it. Like I can sort of get inside Piper's head until mm-hmm. she starts being completely annoying. And then I'm like, I hate you.
Maybe but, that's why I'm so annoyed by her, because she's like my representation on the show. Mm-hmm. Like my type, like, I mean, I definitely didn't grow up with as much money as Piper did, but I'm a white lady and, mm-hmm. you know, live in Connecticut. I think Piper's from Connecticut, you know, yeah. it's a similar type. So maybe that's why I get so angry at Piper, because she acts in ways that there's my countertransference.
Yeah.
or transference. But she, you know, acts in ways that are completely different than the way that I perceive that. We never really know until we're in a situation. But I true. Don't think that I would act the way that Piper acts. And she's just...
She's so entitled.
She's so entitled. And she's,
you would think prison would maybe, like, modify that.
Right, humble her a little bit. Yeah.
But no.
No.
No, she's so easily... She so mm-hmm. easily gets back on her high horse.
Yeah. And she's just... I don't know. Yeah, she's awful. Mm-hmm. But then there's positive things going on elsewhere in the prison. And we definitely have to talk a little bit about Brooke, because this episode was the first time we really got a real flashback mm-hmm. from her. And she, you know, her relationship with Husay is growing. And they're both kind of... Brooke is definitely making... assumptions about Husay, but Husay is also making assumptions about
Brooke.
Yeah,
they're both sort of in love with the idea of each other, it seems, mm-hmm. in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Or at least they're infatuated with the idea of each other.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of maybe, like, a little bit of, like, danger and whatnot with each other in a relationship with someone that's, like, maybe a little bit rougher on the edges mm-hmm. in terms of both of them, because both of them are not from rougher on the edges backgrounds.
Yeah.
They're both from very, you know, like... Well, I don't really know so much about Brooke's home life, because the one
Husay
flashback...
is, like, referring to her as, like, a transient, dirty hippie.
Right. And in the one flashback we got from Brooke last year, we saw her playing a piano, like, in a beautifully appointed house with, like, a tiger mom, basically.
Oh, right. I forgot
yelling
about
at
that.
Her. Yeah. So we know that she probably comes from money as well, and mm-hmm. she comes from this family that was very structured, and she probably wanted to rebel against that. But, you know, both Husay and Brooke... don't, like, when you look at them, they're very, the first opinion you would have of them would be very different mm-hmm. than what they are. Mm-hmm. And that definitely comes into play a lot in this season, the racism that's been kind of growing in the prison. And this is kind of a more innocent example of that, I think.
Yeah.
even though it is pretty horrible.
They're not forming a gang, but they are, you know, they're definitely... Mm-hmm. There's a lot of assumptions going on about mm-hmm. who the other person is. Mm-hmm. And I just love that say anything moment mm-hmm. that brings them back together. And I think it's really big of Husay to be like, all right, mm-hmm. you know, you are just well-meaning and dumb. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'll forgive you and we'll mm-hmm. try and start over.
Yeah. But Brooke's also a little bit sensationalist, because she, in the flashback... Which is actually kind of hard to pin down exactly, like, what, I mean...
What's the purpose of the flashback, kind of?
I mean,
is it just to show that she just really wants to be acknowledged as somebody mm-hmm. who's not just, you know, whatever her background was, but mm-hmm. that she is, like, interested in people and social justice mm-hmm. and maybe even, like, I don't know, just... That she's adventurous, that she's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And she is, but she's not, like, the scene with the sex offender, who really isn't a sex offender. I mean, yeah. he is, but he, you know, he's like Brooke's boyfriend, ex-boyfriend said, he's a cautionary tale, really,
yeah.
In terms of, you know, sex offenders being on that list, because sex offenders are all sorts of different things, not just what, and obviously that's part of what this episode was
right.
saying. But Brooke treats him like a human being. Like, she, even when he's like, what if it was kiddie porn? She's still kind of like,
she just takes deep breath and she's like, I would think you need support.
Yeah. And like, like, she would probably be a good counselor. Like, she sees him for a person. Like, okay, like, maybe you have all these issues, but you're still someone who is worthy of being treated like a human being. And that's mm-hmm. She was, but she wasn't. She was going there for the $50. So, yeah, it's like
she was also, I mean, watching that, I was thinking about, like, social workers who do home visits. And I mm-hmm. was thinking, like, why would you put yourself in a situation that mm-hmm. that's so potentially dangerous to you mm-hmm. for $50 and a boyfriend?
Right.
You know, like, she's right. She's pretty rash mm-hmm. in terms of, like, I don't really trust her decision-making ability.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't know how much better it's gotten, but that was a pretty... dumb thing to do, really.
Yeah, she doesn't make the best decisions. That's definitely true. And she is kind of, you know, like a follow, like the last season with the whole Norma plotline, she kind of was very quick to follow that. So she's very much trying to find who she is. I guess that's kind of what the whole thing was about. Yeah. And she's just desperate to kind of fit in anywhere. So like later when she goes, I'm working this out as we talk about it, later when she goes and she talks to her ex-boyfriend and her potential future boyfriend, although I think he was trying to say he was gay, I'm not sure, but
really?
Like he was kind of like, he was like, I'm not really into, like, and then she cuts him off, so I wasn't sure if that was like,
oh,
he was gay or maybe he wasn't into her, but she's so cute, so I don't know.
I didn't catch that. He seemed pretty stoked about it in the end when she was,
and
like,
that's true, yeah.
When she was like, oh yeah, and you owe me $50 and you have to take me on a date.
Yeah, that's true, so maybe he was exploring, I don't know. But
maybe
then,
he was just thrilled by the idea of what she had done to
right,
have a date with him.
Right, and like, and she was being sensational at the end and at the expense of this poor guy who had told her, like, you know, revealed
he really
to her.
He really opened up to her, and then she kind of sold
yeah,
him.
And then she sold him. I mean, not like he's ever going to know, but...
No.
But
his life is ruined anyway, which I guess is the point of that, part of the plot.
Hopefully they build that superstore and not that park. So that he doesn't have to move. But
he had some pretty nice digs, though, for somebody who probably has a hard time getting a job.
Mm-hmm.
And,
that's
know.
True. And he did still have that, like, porn mustache going on.
I think they definitely made that decision so that we would feel like she might be in danger.
That's definitely. And he had all, like, the old-fashioned furniture and stuff, too, which was a little...
Maybe his mom's house.
But it was kind of showing her... You know, she was desperate to kind of fit in anywhere. And, you know, maybe with the Pusey thing, she was like, oh, well, I'm in jail. I need, like, someone who's a little, like, tougher and savvy to, like, be with. But then she realized that Pusey wasn't that, but still wanted to try. And that was really sweet. I really liked that scene with the two of them. And the Say Anything moment with the M&M. And she was like, nothing else came in. This is not like a...
yeah. It's not a reference to you being black and therefore liking hip-hop.
Yes, even though it was M&M, which is he's white, so, but, you know. Actually, it's funny because my sister, who's a tiny white girl, she loves M&M. And so I was like, can you listen to the song? Because my SoundHound wouldn't tag it.
Mm.
And I was like, can you listen to this song so you can tell me what it is? And then it ended up being the song in the credits. And I was like, oh okay, so it's the same song. But you know,
I couldn't hear it very well either. I would never have identified it as M&M.
Yeah, well, I only did because my sister's constantly playing M&M. And I was like, can you listen to this so you can? And she was like, oh, it's the same song in the credits. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But yeah, that was really sweet. And especially since, you know, the prison doesn't get any other music. But then they had each other at the end. So it was a beginning of a sweet relationship. And so a couple odds and ends. We didn't really talk about Vinny and Lorna. Lorna's another, like, I don't even know what I would diagnose her. Like, she's definitely, like, compulsive liar. Like, ooh. But I don't know what...
But she's kind of delusional, right?
She is a little delusional, yeah, but...
I mean, to be so in love with this guy that you've had one date with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she kind of lives in a fantasy world.
She does. Although they do seem to be connected, because the scene in the visitation
room... Oh, yeah, well, I mean, honestly, like... That's probably good for this relationship that she so easily goes into fantasy because she's, you know, she's really good at phone sex. So,
yeah, she is.
You know, so I think that maybe she's actually taking this trait and turning it from a liability into an asset.
That's true. Yeah, she's, and she, you know, even though we've seen in previous seasons what she's capable of when she's in a relationship, everyone, I still kind of feel for her. And I still, you know, she's definitely still someone that I feel positively about when I watch her. But she and Vinny are obviously in the visitation room, and I feel like that was like one of the funniest moments of this entire season.
That was really funny. Like, I looked over at my fiance and his ears were turning red. You know, like, it's just like, it's a little bit embarrassing to watch, but it's so exciting.
Yeah.
And just watching everyone else's reaction in the visitation room, that poor little girl who could have been like 10, you know, just like, what's happening?
And Gloria with her son, she's like, eyes
she's
on me.
Like, oh, don't look over there.
And Bailey, the guard, is just kind of like, what?
But meanwhile, you know, Gloria's talking about Brissette.
Right, that's true. Yeah,
right?
And who we haven't seen yet this season, which I do think in part was probably due to her scheduling conflicts, but in a way, you know, it's definitely a really important story that they need to be telling with the solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And they did tell it a little bit in previous seasons with Piper, and I think Watson was down there for a little bit too, and she was in there for like a week, and she came out and she was traumatized, and Piper was there and drawing stuff on the walls with her food, and you know, solitary confinement is not, it's not a place for people to be, and it, yeah, and it shouldn't really, you know, be used as punishment, but it is, and like you said, there's reform
or,
going on.
Or, you know, quote-unquote protection for mm-hmm. Sophia.
Right. So Sophia's in there for zero reason. She's in there for her own good, which is just not...
It's nonsense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a feeling, I haven't seen the last couple episodes, but I have a feeling that's not going to go well for her.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really, I mean, I just really like her as a character.
Yeah, yeah. She's had some struggles, definitely, mm-hmm. and she's had... You know, there are, you know, transgender people or people who have made the transition in jails, and they're, you know, it's tough because mm-hmm. people aren't, the guards are certainly not trained. Like, mm-hmm. who has the money to train guards in gender sensitivity training and all of that specific...
In any kind of sensitivity training.
In
frankly.
Any kind of sensitivity.
And then you got people like Piscatella who, mm-hmm. you know, have this sort of, like, very binary view of, mm-hmm. like, guard versus inmate, mm-hmm. and there's no gray area, so, like... You know, if you're trying to maintain order as your number one priority, like, do you want to be sensitive?
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. Like, we're coming from, like, a counseling / like, therapy background mm-hmm. where, like, of course we want to be sensitive, mm-hmm. you know? And we know that, like, if you avoid riling people up, you'll probably have a quieter, more peaceful prison, right?
That's true. Mm-hmm.
But he's not really coming from that perspective.
Yeah, he's, like you said, he wants to keep the order, mm-hmm. and he wants to everyone to know that he's the boss and that he's to be respected or else, mm-hmm. really. And fear, while it can be a good motivator, it's not necessarily the best motivator mm-hmm. To keep people in order. But to kind of go back to Brissette, he's never met Brissette because
right.
she's been in the SHU this entire time. So,
right.
So he, I don't even know... You know, with the structure changing so rapidly, I don't really know how much he knows about the people who are in SHU, if he knows anything. But, you know, obviously Caputo knows, and Gloria's trying to get her son to get Brissette's wife in to
yeah.
kind of do something about
and
it.
And that's, it's so tragic because you just see, like, you know, even with somebody who has support outside of the prison, like Brissette, I mean, she's got people who love her, and... Even they are powerless to do
mm-hmm.
anything about it. They don't know if she's alive or dead. You know, like, they have no contact with her.
Mm-hmm.
She has no contact with them. It must be incredibly dehumanizing and demoralizing.
Right.
So I really feel annoyed with Caputo that he's not
mm-hmm.
making this a priority because it just feels, like, so unjust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was saying kind of, I think at the end of last season, like, let's put Brissette in the SHU, like, temporarily, like, so that we can make these changes,
mm-hmm.
so that I can affect better change in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what comes with being, you know, an administrator. You have
mm-hmm.
to, there are things that you have to trade off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for him, I think, and we'll definitely see more about that
mm-hmm.
as the season progresses. But, you know, as far as that goes, it's a tragic thing that does happen. But like you said, the Rikers, you know, they... What did they say about solitary? If you're under 21,
oh,
you can't be...
Yeah, they just decided that, like, people under 21 cannot be placed in solitary.
Mm-hmm. Which is something that... I'm not sure if Rikers has any private funding, but private prisons, and this isn't a spoiler, really, but later on in the season, they say that they can't get any sort of information from the prison about Brissette because
yeah.
it's a private corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that that's the case. I believe that private corporations can't be compelled to release their information because they're a company. They're not the government. They don't have to, like, be...
It just feels like a major civil rights violation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is.
I mean, just
yeah.
even... But on a larger scale, to have private corporations be in
mm-hmm.
charge of people's lives,
mm-hmm.
I can't believe that we're sort of farming out that thing. You know, it just... It feels really bad to me that
yeah.
we are... I mean, these are human beings, and they are really being treated like commodities in
yeah.
the show.
Well, and the government, I mean, this is kind of a little off topic, but the government is so strapped. I don't know if you saw this week in the New York Times, there was an article about how they're privatizing 911, and it's becoming, like, a big issue where they don't, like there's no one there on the other end because they only have so many people staffing.
Well, I saw the John Oliver Last Week Tonight episode about that, and it was horrifying.
Yeah, well, he didn't talk about the privatization of it, though.
No, he didn't, but just the fact that, like, you know, a third of the time or something like that, 911 can't find you, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's terrifying.
It is terrifying. 911, well, that's a whole other thing, but...
Yeah.
But, yeah.
But, I mean, it is a cash flow issue, it's a manpower issue, it's a technology issue. I mean, you'd think that these are things that we would prioritize.
And our government is, I mean, I don't know where all the money's going, I don't know, we're strapped, but it's not going into these... I mean, 911 is a whole different thing, but in terms of mental health in prisons, it's not going into the preventative stuff, it's going into the back end.
It's so short-sighted.
It is.
And you have to believe that if there's private corporations involved, that it's motivated by that, and it's, you know, who knows about, like, what kind of campaign donations they're making, and I'm sure there's a whole world of, like, private backroom deals. And I sound like Lolly right now, but I'm sure there is, like, a whole world that you and I have no awareness of.
That's true.
That's maintaining this system that really doesn't serve anybody very well.
And that's another thing that I wanted to explore a little bit on the show. I'm, you know, still kind of delving into articles and looking at stuff, but, like, how can we change things? And, you know, what can we do? And obviously there's, you know, you can... write to your congressman and things like that, but there's definitely other things that we can do too, and I'm looking into it. If anyone out there has any suggestions, send them to me, because we want to look into that more as we go along, you know, because these are things that need to be changed in order for our society to, you know, run smoother, I guess. I don't know. It's like a very small way of putting it.
I think we're lucky in Connecticut that we have some pretty aware Congress people. I mean, look at, like, you know, the recent sit-in in Congress and, you know, luckily, like, Jim Himes and I'm forgetting the other Connecticut...
The senator? Chris Murphy was the...
Murphy, yeah. You know, they were pretty outspoken and in lobbying for change in terms of, like, you know, criminals being able to buy a gun and suspected terrorists being able to buy a gun. And I know that it's not the same issue, but I do feel like, you know, we're kind of lucky here that we've got people who are actually looking at social issues and interested in making social change. And so I think that lobbying is definitely something that's underutilized by the majority of people. Lobbying your congresspeople, lobbying your legislators for...
And there are definite ways to do... You can call your congresspeople.
Yeah, you can call them right up. You can send them an email. There's so many ways to get your point across now.
Yeah.
And I think so few people... I think people are really just jaded with the process. Which feels really scary for the election coming up. I feel like there's going to be... I feel like there will probably be low voter turnout from people like me who just feel completely like, what's even happening anymore? Like, does my vote even matter?
Well, even to, you know, not even be partisan, both Hillary and Trump, who are, you know, well, Hillary's still presumptive nominee, right? She's like, but the two, you know, main candidates are the lowest rated presidential candidates, like some of the lowest rated in history. I don't know if not the lowest rated. So, you know, no one's really in love with
either. There's so much apathy right now.
Yeah, and that's tough. But there are ways to affect change, even one person at a time. So we're going to definitely look into that more, and I'll put a link to how to, I should really put a link to that in every podcast, but how to contact your Congress people and your senators, because it's important to know that you can do that. And, you know, I didn't really, I mean, I think, like, on the periphery I knew, but it should be something that they should teach kids in, like, all their U.S. history classes. Like, okay, you can write your congressperson, like, even as a kid, you can do, you know, these are small things that you can do, because there are our elected officials, they're supposed to be our voices. And, you know, the voters, if you, you know, if enough people come together and say they want something, they have to listen. So, all right, so the very end of the episode, Frida is talking about how they have to kill Lolly, which is, like, I love how Orange is the New Black, even though it's a bingeable show, I think it's so bingeable because they end every episode on, like, such a cliffhanger, like, almost. So the end of this episode, Frida's like, we have to kill Lolly. And obviously, as viewers, we're all like, no, but, like, we kind of also understand why they would need to kill Lolly, because Lolly's kind of a, you know...
She's a liability.
She's definitely a liability.
She
for
doesn't
them right now.
Really. She does. She can't really control her outbursts or what she says, or, you know, and certainly under more stress, she has less control over that. So, Yeah, I mean, you could see why they think this is the solution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, at least Frida, why Frida thinks
it's the solution. Yeah, yeah, but I feel like, you know, Voss is like, that sounds nuts, and I also see why you're saying it, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, we're all kind of Voss in that
they're
moment.
They're pretty terrified mm-hmm. For either outcome. You mm-hmm. know, either she gives away the game or they have to offer.
Mm-hmm. And she, well, yeah, well, yeah, that's later on in the season. But yeah, and so it's just tough. And we did talk a little bit already about, you know, how to treat, you know, paranoid schizophrenics or people with severe mental health disabilities. But she's not getting anything. Like, Healy hasn't even come around to talk to her yet. Like, there's mm-hmm. nothing going on. And it's just concerning, especially since she probably went in with a like she's got a file.
Yeah.
And the file probably has some sort of information on her diagnosis in it. She's been to multiple different prisons. So, mm-hmm. you know, although she does say, I think last season she was basically like, this is like a, you know, a country club compared to where I came yeah. from. So, and that was before the influx of new prisoners, but
she strikes me as a person who can like pull it together enough. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people, often who like in certain situations, they can sort of like tamp it down mm-hmm. and appear to kind of like pass. Like they're not having hallucinations
or themselves.
They're sort of like get by when they need to, sometimes in the psychiatrist's office. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards yeah. like, you know, it kind of just leaks out. And you know, she might be one of those people who under ordinary circumstances, maybe she just kind of keeps it on the DL.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And now, I mean, she's killed someone, like that would probably send me over the edge, mm-hmm. you know? So it's possible that before, like, she wasn't identified as needing services.
Mm-hmm.
Even, you know, even though later, like, we see kind of, like, her backstory and we think, like, obviously this person's always needed services, mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. from the moment of her onset of her illness.
But, right.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the fact that, like, they're just, like, packed in there like sardines and mm-hmm. nobody's getting individual attention. And mm-hmm. so somebody like her who isn't acting out violently most of the time or isn't causing a problem, like, why would they spend the time, the money to, like, counsel her, medicate her, whatever?
Yeah, that's true. I guess maybe she wouldn't, but, yeah, would she or wouldn't? I'm not sure if she would have come in with a diagnosis because maybe the system failed her in that way as well. Maybe no one, you know, took the time to properly diagnose her. Maybe mm-hmm. paperwork got lost in the shuffle. Who knows? But even, you know, crazy Suzanne, who they clearly know has mental health mm-hmm. issues, I don't think we've once, I keep thinking about this and I'm like, and I know that we've never seen her. I mean, we've seen her speak to Birdie, but we've never seen her like in counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep saying this because every time I think about it, I'm so incredulous that she's yeah. not getting any help. She's not yeah. getting anything.
Well, I mean, when you think about it, part of the reason for that might be that, like, at least at this point in the show, she's pretty high functioning.
Mm-hmm.
She gets along pretty well. Like, you could argue that her mental health issues are not really interfering with her ability to make social connections mm-hmm. or to do her job in the prison, which is mm-hmm. like cleaning the stalls.
Well, so, the job's helping her, actually. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
which, you know, work often is something that helps people mm-hmm. To have something meaningful to do with their time and to have something that they look forward to and that they can be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
So she's kind of, even though she's in prison, she's kind of got a lot of her basic needs being met.
That's true. And she has friends and...
Which yeah. I consider a basic need, actually.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
I
mean, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, social isolation is extremely detrimental mm-hmm. to somebody with mental
health.
Well,
just like the solitary.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. that's what they're doing to a lot of the people with severe mental health issues, are just throwing them in solitary when mm-hmm. they act out instead of... But that's a whole other... But yeah, we've never seen Crazy Eyes in solitary, thank mm-hmm. God, because mm-hmm. who knows what that would do to her. Because
yeah.
she does need human... She's very much in need of human... Like, that's something that she needs, and yes. she's getting now more and more...
She's really desperate for it. I mean, that's why mm-hmm. she glommed on to V so hard. That's why she probably glommed on to Piper.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Suzanne is really, like, a person who wants to fit in and wants to belong and wants to be part of a community.
Mm-hmm. And you're right, she is kind of high-functioning now, but I just, you know, especially for someone with... You know, more obvious mental health issues mm-hmm. that, you know, a regular or normal prison has a much higher population of those types of people mm-hmm. than they have a lot more lollies and crazy eyes than Litchfield has. Mm-hmm. Litchfield has, you know, a lot of very high functioning people, mm-hmm. at least the ones that we see. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously there are like 300 prisoners there, 350 or something, but we know a lot of them. Like, mm-hmm. we see by name or we see them frequently mm-hmm. in the background. I think there's like 50 or 60 named prisoners, so we know a good chunk of them.
I just wonder if, you know, a lot of them may be suffering with like depression, anxiety, mm-hmm. things that wouldn't necessarily be like highlighted on the show. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is that like maybe the ones who are acting out or who are having episodes, maybe they're getting sent to the shoe mm-hmm. and they're just not,
we just don't see them.
They're just not. Yeah. We don't see them.
We don't see the really ill people. but yeah, it's definitely something to think about. There was an article I read recently, especially since with my substance abuse background, they've mm-hmm. said something along the lines of there are, oh God, it was like 60% of the population. Oh God, I shouldn't even be quoting this, but it was like a large percent of the population had substance abuse issues mm-hmm. and like 5% were getting treatment for it. And something similar with mental health. And it's like, we're not treating people with their issues mm-hmm. and then they come out and then they're like, there's nothing there for them. So, you know, what can we do there?
And they get socialized to the prison system. And mm-hmm. then, you know, once you're out, who knows how long some of them have been in there. I don't mm-hmm. know how long Suzanne's been in there.
But right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, I can't see her doing too well on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Unless maybe, like, she lived with her parents and, you know, they just took care of her. I don't know.
Well, the structure of the prison seems to be good for her, too. Because even in the first episode, she's like, she was kind of, like, reminded me of, like, Rain Man, like, gotta get back for Wapner. Like, she was like, because she's, you know, she has more cognitive ability, I think, than, well, I don't know, who knows about Ray from,
Different cognitive ability.
What was Dustin Hoffman's name in Rain Man? I can't even remember.
Raymond
was the brother, right?
Oh, you're right.
Because he was Raymond.
I just don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember either. I'm trying to remember.
It's been too long.
Oh my God, it's killing me. But anyway, but he, you know, it was kind of the same thing. Like, she needed that structure. She needed that, like, mm-hmm. I do this at this time and this at this time, and I have this job and I have this mm-hmm. responsibility. Mm-hmm. And she really is institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And it's sad because, like you said, when she gets out, where does she go? She goes to live with her elderly parents who mm-hmm. probably don't necessarily have the, you know, capacity to take that. She needs a Laurel House.
She does. She needs a Laurel House.
She needs a Laurel House.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, like, what they focus on there is, like, helping people, like, even with cognitive remediation, with supported mm-hmm. employment, with supported education, supported mm-hmm. housing. So trying to provide all those wraparound services that mm-hmm. If you didn't have a mental health disorder, you'd probably still need all that stuff. It would mm-hmm. just be a lot. You know, you'd have a lot fewer obstacles to getting it and providing a community, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think Suzanne's one of my favorite characters in that show.
I know. It's easy to love her.
I love her. She's so funny, and she's mm-hmm. she's caring in a way, and she's interesting. Mm-hmm. I can't get enough of her.
Mm-hmm. She is, and the performance, Uzo Aduba, is just amazing mm-hmm. in the show, too. She carries it off so well, mm-hmm. and definitely interested to see more from her as the season progresses. All right, well, so to end the chat, I'm going to try something a little new. The past couple episodes, and Orange is the New Black in general, has a ton of pop culture references going on.
Mm-hmm.
So this one, there's, like, a whole bunch, but I was just going to say, like, we should talk about our favorites, and then, like, I'll put some on the link or the website to talk about, you know, all the different pop culture references here, mm-hmm. because there were so many. There was, like, the rehab addict one I thought was really funny when Tasty was like, it's rehab addicts with actual rehab or with actual addicts. But my favorite was a Shawshank reference. Tasty is always so funny, and she's really good with all the references. The mm-hmm. the group of black girls are always really good with all the pop culture references, but she refers to Shawshank Redemption, and I think you said you're not really like,
it's been a while since I saw Shawshank.
I just, like, watch it every time.
She's like, I'm not going to climb through a sewer and pull, like, piss and dookie.
She was like, what'd she say? She's like, I don't want to get thrown in the shoe because I did your taxes too good or something. And that's hilarious. And then actually, she made a good point. She was like, what if you need food stamps or something and I need to, like, fill out your paperwork? And I was like, that's something that Tasty, like, that's a skill that she has from mm-hmm. her life mm-hmm. because she probably had to do that because that system is, like, difficult to get through.
Yeah.
getting any sort of support from the government is very, very difficult. But I was like, oh, that's a good point. Tasty has these
skills
that Caputo doesn't necessarily have, mm-hmm. and she could be Shawshanked, you know? Like, but Caputo is better than the warden on that.
Yeah.
But that was definitely my favorite.
I think also Tasty related, but I I liked the, because I'm a huge Game of Thrones mm-hmm. nerd, I really liked the Warden of, what was she? She was the Hand of the Warden.
Yes.
I was going to say the Warden of the North, and that's not.
Well, well, that's kind of Caputo, right?
Yeah. But, yeah, she's the Hand of the Warden, which which is cool. Yeah. I like.
I think Cindy said that. Oh, no, she said, shows. Tasty did say that, yeah.
Yeah.
And then they were like, and then someone said winter is coming, and I was like, oh. Uh-huh. Because we are kind of in that point of the show where
winter is here.
Winter. Well, yeah, on Game of Thrones.
But I won't also, do too much crossover.
But. Yeah, well, no, but it's true. Because also on Orange is the New Black, kind of like we were talking about, it's getting in this point now, it's kind of transitioning from the more comedy based mm-hmm. stuff to the more drama. So winter is coming.
Yeah. But they still throw us our little comedic tidbits, which I enjoy.
Yeah, they do, which are good. And this one had a big one, like I said, with the Vinny and Lorna, because that was like one of the funniest scenes I think that have ever. And that and Red with the snoring in like last episode.
Yeah.
Those were two really, really good sequences that I thought.
That
were.
Was another one where I looked at my fiance and we just looked at each other and was like, do you ever want to smother me with a pillow? I'm like, sometimes. You might find yourself jerry rigged tomorrow in some sort of crazy configuration.
Bra on his head. Yeah, books under his. Yeah, well, at least he doesn't have to sleep in a bunk bed.
True story.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that would be awful. So, all right. Well, I think we did it.
Yes.
Yay. So, and it's nice just about the pop culture references to have those in there and have a little levity because we are dealing with such
heavy serious material. Topics. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think the show does a really great job of balancing like giving the serious topics their due
mm-hmm.
and also like keeping it light enough that we don't feel totally bummed out when we stop watching the show.
Right. Yes. That's very true. So, all right. Well, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Erin.
Oh, you're welcome anytime. And this will be up soon, and I hope you guys all enjoyed it. So until next time, you guys can reach us at Twitter at You've Got Time Pod, or email You've Got Time Podcast at gmail.com, or on Facebook, facebook.com/You've Got Time Podcast. All right, bye guys. Thanks.